Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is Thursday. So the weekend is coming, and it's October 9th. We're in the nervous system, chapter 7. We're in the middle of lecture, and we're progressing to the end of this chapter. Probably won't finish it today, but maybe finish it today. So today is a Thursday. Next Thursday, we're going to have a lecture, of course, on autonomic nervous system, and maybe get into sensory physiology. And then the Tuesday right after that is your second exam on chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. So how many weeks away is that? One and a half weeks away. Okay? So don't forget that next exam is on a Thursday. The first one was on a Tuesday. And then the next one's going to be on a Thursday once again. And then the last one, no, the next one must be on a Tuesday. I meant for it to be on a Tuesday. So it says Thursday here. And then the very last day of the semester, Thursday once again. Oh, Monday. So the first two were on Mondays. The first two were on Tuesdays. The last two will be on Thursday. So every lab gets the same amount of, you have a lab quiz and a lecture exam on the same day. That's not so bad. All right. Does anybody have any questions on the schedule? What do you bring to an exam? What do you bring? Picture ID. What else? Don't forget that picture ID. It's a hassle if you don't bring it. So please bring it. What else? You need, oh yeah, Scantron. I think it's an 88, it says right here. It's an 882, maybe an E, 882E. Don't get the 882 Lovas. That doesn't work very well. Where do I have that? Yeah, 882E, not that Lovas form. And then, so Scantron pencil, because it's a Scantron, and a really good eraser. Make sure you have a really good eraser. No smudges. Because maybe after this test, I won't give credit if you have a smudge, and it sort of looks like you have the right answer penciled in, but the Scantron reader or the computer can't see it. I'm going to believe the computer. All right, so make sure you hand in a really nice and clean Scantron. Just like if it was a board exam, for instance. Okay, so last time we started nervous system, and we sure spent a lot of time on anatomy. We looked at the different cells, two major kinds of cells in the nervous system. They're neurons and neuroglia. Which ones transmit electrical information, neurons or neuroglia? Neurons, yep. And neuroglia just help neurons do their job by providing a special chemical environment for them, by recycling neurotransmitters, by secreting compounds that stimulate growth of dendrites, and even during development, growth of axons between different parts of the brain and peripheral nervous system, make cerebral spinal fluid, all kinds of interesting things. And people are really interested in neuroglia more now, maybe more so than even neurons. Early on, people were only interested in neurons, but not so much anymore. Okay, so I'm going to put the schedule away, and we're just going to look at some slides. We ended up talking about an action potential. What does potential mean, once again? What does potential mean? Yeah, it means voltage, and a voltage just means a difference in electrical charge. That's potential energy, because what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other, right? And so if you have a separation in charge, those opposite charges will attract each other, so they'll move by just that electrical attraction. And action potentials, I just want you to memorize this, maybe after today's lecture and you do some study and you'll be more familiar with this, but right now just memorize that an action potential is produced by voltage-gated channels. When we looked at some other channels last time, and those are ligand-gated channels. So there are two main kinds of channels that a neuron has. There are voltage-gated channels that produce what? Voltage-gated channels produce action potentials, right? And then there are ligand-gated channels that produce something that we call graded potentials. Graded potentials. Okay. All right, so we're looking at action potential. So if we go back a couple slides, why can't I go back a couple slides? Here you go. If we look over here, I see a membrane protein or protein that moves across the membrane or spans the membrane. Part of it is extracellular, part of it is intracellular. What is this beast right here? What is this thing? It changes shape. Right, right now, this, there is no space for anything to move through this protein from extracellular to intracellular. And then when it changes its shape, changes conformation, now you have a nice canal through this protein, and that connects the outside of the cell and the inside of the cell. This is what we call a channel. This is a channel, an ion channel. All right, so why does an ion need a channel to get across the membrane? That's maybe a good place to start. Why does an ion need a channel to get across this membrane right here? Because the inside is a layer of oil, right? It is nonpolar. And ions are polar. Those compounds will never mix together, so ions cannot move across a cell membrane because this layer of oil or lipid in the very center of that membrane. That will exclude water and all polar kinds of compounds. So a polar compound like an ion need a special pathway, and we call that an ion channel. But this is kind of a special ion channel because it has this little appendage right here, and that's just an illustration of what? What does this illustrate, this little appendage? That is a gate. That's right. So even though the channel is open in this conformation, if the gate swings up into the channel, then it occludes the channel and it blocks the motion of ions across the membrane, which is what we see in this condition right here. All right. So what causes this gate to close? And what causes this ion channel to go from a closed configuration to an open configuration? What causes that? Okay, it's just the voltage across the membrane. That's right. So remember, at a resting membrane potential, it's negative on the inside, and so then it's positive on the outside. It's always with respect to each other. And as that voltage changes, it produces little tensions and twists this molecule a little bit, produces a little motive force, and it changes the conformation of the protein to where this channel opens up. And then sooner or later, right, if the voltage changes a lot, then this gate will even move into position and close off the channel. So this is a voltage-gated channel. It's either opened or closed or gated and closed, and that's due just according to the voltage across the membrane. All right, and what does a voltage-gated channel do, like this one? What can it produce? An action potential, right? And last time we talked about action potentials quite a bit. Here is one. Make sure you know all the different components. And in order to stimulate an action potential, what do you need? You need a stimulus. You need an excitatory stimulus, which moves the cell from resting membrane potential back towards zero. And when it reaches that threshold, then a whole bunch of voltage-gated channels will open up, like sodium. And of course, we know sodium is high outside the cell. And sodium is a cation and is negative inside the cell, so it will diffuse in and it will be pulled in by that electrical charge. So sodium is going to rush inside the cell, and that causes depolarization of the cell. Okay, and as the cell becomes more polarized, that opens more sodium channels, and so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism that produces this big spike in an action potential. So action potential is not a constant voltage. It's a voltage that is changing, and it's changing very rapidly. That's where the term action came from. Okay, so what kind of potential is not an action potential on this illustration right here? Which kind of potential is not an action potential? What about stimulus? That's a voltage that's moving around, right? It's changing. So I wouldn't call that a constant voltage, but what is constant? Resting membrane potential, right? So if the voltage is not changing, then we call that resting membrane potential, right? If it is changing, then we can call that an action potential if it has this form. Okay, there's another form of a potential that we're going to call a graded potential a little bit later today. But right now, we're still talking about action potentials, and they are due to those gated voltage channels. All right, so where did we leave off? We left off pretty much right about over here. This just says that an action potential occurs by diffusion, and because there's a gradient of electrical charge, it's not an active process. An action potential is a passive process. So it does not directly require ATP. So action potentials can be transmitted by neurons even after the cell can't make any ATP, even after the cell dies for a short period of time. But after the action potential occurs, if the cell is alive and has ATP, then the sodium-potassium pump works to reestablish the proper concentrations of sodium and potassium across the cell membrane. Okay, and then the cell gets back to resting membrane potential. So here is sort of an illustration of the action potential, right? So here we have a cell at rest at RMP, and then there's this rapid depolarization, right, because the voltage goes up to zero and then even overshoots. So what are we looking at? We're looking at membrane voltage versus time. If we were to measure it, it would look something like this. So this depolarization is due to a motion of what kind of ion? What kind of ion is moving? Yeah, sodium. And which way is it moving? Inside the cell, right? And then there's recovery of that voltage back down to resting membrane potential. We call that repolarization. And is that due to the same ion? Nope, it's due to a different ion. It's due to potassium. And which way does potassium move? Same way as sodium? Opposite way. All right, and so remember, potassium is a cation, so when it leaves the cell becomes more negative. We call that repolarization. So on this top diagram, we see that here is the action potential. The action potential is due to the motion of these two ions. The bottom curve over here shows the permeability of the membrane to these two ions. So I see two bumps. So after threshold voltage is reached, where do you see the most motion taking place? Is it by a sodium or through a potassium channel? You see sodium is very rapid to respond to a stimulus, and potassium is slower, right? And that's why depolarization happens first, followed by repolarization. So both of these gates get triggered at the same time, but it's just that the potassium gates are slower to open, and so they have an effect on the last part of this action potential, right? Not the initial part, but the last part. Okay, so that's the action of an action potential. So on this slide, we can think of this as a graph of two different things, right? We can look at this graph as voltage versus time, or we could look at this as maybe voltage versus distance. Let's look at this as voltage versus time. So the cell is at rest, and it's a nice healthy cell, and if we apply a stimulus, okay, I notice that something is not happening. What is not being produced by so this arrow is a stimulus. What's not happening, even though we're stimulating this nerve? Okay, it hasn't reached threshold, and since it hasn't reached threshold, I do not see an action potential here, right? Do you see an action potential? No action potential, right? So this kind of stimulus, because it doesn't produce an action potential, we call this a sub-threshold potential. Sub-threshold. Right? All right, so then maybe at another later time, we come with our stimulating agent and increase the magnitude of that stimulation, and I can see that the second arrow is a little bit bigger, and it triggers an action potential. So what kind of stimulus is this? Is it sub-threshold? It is not. It is a threshold stimulus, right? And that produces an action potential. All right, so look at the shape of this action potential. And then at another later time, let's come along with that same kind of stimulus, but let's increase the stimulus. And again, I see the arrow getting bigger, and that is not a sub-threshold stimulus. That is a nice threshold stimulus, and that produces an action potential. What can you tell me about the size and shape, duration, or everything about the first action potential compared to the second? What about the amplitude? What about the peak? It's the same. What about the duration? It's the same. Okay? And so the first action potential is exactly the same as the second one here, even though the stimulus has changed a lot. The second one here was weak, and then the third one was a little bit stronger. And then let's come with even a stronger stimulus. Here's the strongest stimulus. You can see this arrow getting really big. And of course, that's a threshold stimulus that produces an action potential. Now, what can you tell me about all three of these action potentials? Are they the same, or do you see some difference in there? The key point here is that all of these action potentials are identical. They have the same duration. They have the same peak amplitude. So all action potentials are the same. They never change. So don't get tricked by any kind of question. You might run into some questions where it really sounds like an action potential is going to change because of something happening inside the cell. But what do you know about action potentials? They are always the same, right? So they never disappear. So instead of looking at this graph as voltage across the cell membrane versus time, we could look at this as voltage across the membrane versus a distance. So let's just say that here is the point of stimulation, so let's forget about these arrows over here. Let's stimulate right here that produces an action potential, and this action potential is going to move down an axon to the axon terminus. So the action potential is moved from this location, right, more distally to this location on an axon, and then all the way at the end of an axon. What is an action potential like as it travels from one point to another? Say at the beginning of an axon to the end of an axon, what can you tell me about that action potential? They're exactly the same. They don't change. We call that traveling without decrement. That signal never dies away. So if we were to have a neuron from here to the moon and we stimulated that neuron and it produced an action potential on Earth, what would happen to that signal by the time it got to the moon? It would be exactly the same. That is pretty amazing. All right, so it travels without decrement. There are other kinds of potentials where that's not true. All right, so what do we want to say? Oh, something else. All right, so action potentials are always the same. Action potentials cannot summate. We can't have an action potential on top of another one, producing, right, a bigger depolarization. And what kinds of channels produce action potentials? What did we say about that? Okay. Voltage-gated channels, yep, produce this action potential. So voltage-gated channels, right, are found only in axons, not on cell bodies, not on dendrites. So if voltage-gated channels are found only on axons, what part of a neuron can produce an action potential? Only the axon. Dendrites and cell bodies cannot produce action potentials. All right, so constant amplitude cannot summate. All right, they're produced by voltage-gated channels, and they propagate without decrement. These are all some very important characteristics of action potentials. All right, so let me stimulate your ears here just a little bit. And I'm not going to sing or anything, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to start talking like this. Okay, you can barely hear me. Can you tell that my voice has changed a little bit? How am I speaking right now? Louder or more softly? More softly, okay. How about if I lecture like this? Can you tell there's a difference in my voice right now? Can you tell that I'm speaking more loud? Yes, you're shaking your head, yes, indeed, all right. So, the language of the nervous system is action potentials. So if one part of the brain receives information, it's in terms of an action potential. And what can you tell me about an action potential? They are all the same, but what about a stimulus? Can a stimulus change intensity? Can I speak softly? And then can I speak loudly? All right. But if a neuron only can speak in action potentials and action potentials can't change, how is it that you can perceive different intensities of a signal or different intensities of a stimulus? This is a pretty interesting question, right? Because when I speak softly and when I speak loud, it's the same action potential because it never changes, right? So how is it that your brain can appreciate a change in intensity if an action potential is always the same? Okay. And you understand it to be sound because it's going to that part of the brain, but I'm just thinking about intensity. Why can we appreciate different intensities? And here is the following reason on this slide. This slide shows it really nicely. Okay, so here we have a stimulus, And you could think of this as visual stimulus or auditory stimulus or pretty much any kind of stimulus on a neuron. And we turn it on at this point in time, so this is voltage versus time. We turn the stimulus on, turn it off, all right? And what kind of stimulus do we see on this first condition? This is a weak, that's right. We want to call this what? Sub-threshold, it's below threshold, so an action potential is not triggered. You see any action potentials here? Indeed not. All right, let's increase the amplitude of the stimulus. Let's talk a little bit louder, for instance. So now I'm talking a little bit louder, so the amplitude of the stimulus is higher. We keep it on for the same period of time. And does that produce any action potentials? Yeah, so this is not sub-threshold. This is at least a threshold stimulus. And what can you tell me about the action potential when we turn the stimulus on and when we turn it off? Same height, and if we were to look really closely, we would see that it's the same duration. Right, they're exactly the same. The first one and this last one over here are exactly the same. All right, now let's start talking really loud. So that increases the stimulus intensity. We turn it on and off for the same period of time in all three conditions. It's only the amplitude that's changing. Okay, and what can you tell me about the action potential, this first action potential due to the third stimulus compared to all of the action potentials that were produced by the second stimulus? Same amplitude. Can you see they're the same amplitude? And I'm going to tell you, if you could measure this accurately, the duration would be exactly the same. But is there a difference, right, in what we see in terms of action potentials in the second condition compared to the third condition when the stimulus was the strongest? Do you see a difference in the membrane voltage? Each action potential is the same, amplitude is the same, duration is the same, but what changes? How many are there for that certain period of time, that same exact period of time? We call that frequency. So the frequency of action potentials going to your brain increases, and that is a signal that the intensity is changing. All right, so even though every action potential is the same, the frequency of action potentials increases. That says that the intensity of the stimulus increases. So what do we call, what's that relationship between stimulus and frequency of action potential? Directly related, that's right. So the number of action potentials per time is directly related to the stimulus intensity. And when the stimulus intensity gets down below threshold, then it doesn't even produce an action potential. All right, so frequency, we call this frequency encoding. So stimulus intensity is frequency encoded. All right, and so I said previously that action potentials are the language of the nervous system, and you could actually listen to these things with some electrodes. So what would that sound like if you have... Right. If we were to listen for action potentials and we have a sub-threshold stimulus, what would that sound like? I shouldn't say anything. I can't describe what it is, right? Because it should be silence. Yeah, it should be silence. No action potentials. Then let's increase the intensity a little bit more. What does your brain hear? The brain doesn't hear a change in any kind of sound level. What does it hear? It hears a blip. Okay? And if the intensity is low, it hears a blip, 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 blip. But if the intensity is high, what does the brain hear? Blip, 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 blip. See, it just hears a higher frequency of blips. Okay? And your brain knows the difference between a visual signal and an auditory signal. I mean, in your brain, it all sounds like a blip, but those blips go to different areas of the brain. Like if it is a visual signal, it's still just blips, where does it go? It goes to the occipital lobe. Yeah, you all know that. But if it's an auditory signal, does it go to the occipital lobe? No, it's the same blips, but it goes to the temporal lobe. Right. So there are different regions in the brain responsible for different sensations. And that's how you can separate sensations out. But the amplitude is always encoded as directly related to the frequency of action potentials. Okay. So that's how you can tell the difference in intensity and also what kind of stimulus it is. All right, so how do we explain that frequency encoding? All right, it has to do with refractory periods of these voltage-gated channels. They can't always be open. Sometimes they're closed. And we said that they cannot summate. You can't add another action potential on top of another one. And that's because of something we call the absolute refractory period. Once an action potential starts, right, another one cannot come along until the first one is over. And even after that, for a period of time, another action potential cannot take place. So we can't put action potentials on top of each other. That's why they always have the same intensity. So there are two kinds of refractory period, which we see on an action potential. Okay, here is the absolute refractory period. An absolute refractory period just means that no matter what the stimulus intensity is, it can never stimulate another action potential to take place. And I think probably a good way to realize that is what happens, why does sodium stop moving into the cell right at this point right here? Because of that gate that closes, right? And if that gate is closed, no intensity of a stimulus will be able to open that gate up at that point in time. So that's what we call absolute refractory. When the membrane voltage gets back down to zero, then the gate opens up, right? But since potassium is still leaving the cell, which we saw on this slide right here, potassium is still leaving the cell, it is still repolarizing, and it repolarizes past resting membrane potential, and it hyperpolarizes. So this is what we call the relative refractory period. An action potential can be stimulated in this region right here of an action potential, but what? It's after the action potential takes place. But what is the nature of the stimulus now that's required to trigger an action potential? It's got to go to minus 55. All right, but initially it was from what? Minus 70 to minus 55. What is that stimulus that is in terms of millivolts? That's a 15 millivolt stimulus. All right, but in the relative refractory period, will a 15 millivolt stimulus trigger an action potential? It will be subthreshold during the relative refractory period. What kind of stimulus is necessary? All right, let's just say 50, maybe it's a 30, 15 and 15, maybe a 30 millivolt stimulus, right? And so what is changing from a 15 millivolt stimulus to a 30 millivolt stimulus? The intensity of the stimulus, right? So as the intensity of the stimulus increases, then it can overcome this relative refractory period. And when it overcomes this relative refractory period, then an action potential can happen soon after the first one. You don't have to wait around for this relative refractory period to go away before an action potential can be stimulated. All right, so the higher the intensity, then this relative refractory period can be overcome, and another action potential will happen sooner than, okay, if it was just a threshold stimulus. So where would a second action potential take place if the second stimulus was exactly the same as the first, or a 15 millivolt stimulus? Where could that happen? Only after the relative refractory period, which means there would be a big lag in time between the first one and the second one. But if the next stimulus has a higher intensity twice, then it can stimulate an action potential sooner compared to when you just have the regular threshold stimulus. So that's how we explain changes in frequency of these action potentials, right? And that is due to that relative refractory period that has to be overcome with a stronger stimulus. And what do we call that? We call that frequency encoding. So remember, how does your brain talk, how do different parts of your brain talk to each other, or one neuron to another? It is with a blip. It just sounds like a blip if you were to listen to it. Okay. All right, so that was action potential. Action potential is due to what kind of membrane proteins? Voltage-gated channels, right? Voltage-gated channels. We're going to talk about another kind of condition that electrical signals can be transmitted through living tissue or an axon. And these we're going to call graded potentials. And they can be conducted along an axon as well, but also dendrites and cell bodies. So a graded potential means that sometimes it has a high intensity, sometimes it has a really low intensity. That's a graded potential. So if we look at this plot of voltage versus distance along say, an axon, could you tell that, this signal right here, as it's moving along, is not an action potential? Could you tell this is not an action potential? First, say yes or no. Yes. Okay. So what clue are you using to determine whether this is an action potential or not? They're not the same amplitude, right? So the amplitude is decreasing, which is not an action potential. And when a potential can have different amplitudes, we say it is graded, right? A graded potential can have different kinds of amplitudes. It can be really high or really low. It's just some kind of electrical disturbance that we can measure across the membrane. Okay. These graded potentials are not due to voltage-gated channels. They're due to ligand-gated channels. And a ligand is just some kind of small molecule that binds to a receptor. So a molecule, so there has to be a receptor, and it's got to have a space where a signaling compound is going to bind to that receptor. That signaling compound is what we call a ligand. I'm just going to use that term from now on. A ligand is something that binds to a receptor. Okay, so let's stimulate this axon with this little, well, you could consider this a needle or an electrode, either one doesn't matter, right? Because what we're going to do is that we're going to somehow inject positive charge into this axon. So what happens to the axon if we inject something positive to it? It's going to depolarize, right? Because the inside of the cell is negative, and then we're going to change that by putting something positive inside the cell that causes depolarization, and we know that to be an excitatory signal that's going to excite the cell. That electrical signal is going to move through, in this particular case, an axon. Okay, the axon has resistance to that flow of electricity, so as it flows through the cell, guess what happens to the amplitude? It starts to decrease as it moves from one region of an axon down to another region of an axon. And the best way maybe to think of that is that there is resistance to the flow of electricity inside of an axon. It's not a superconducting kind of material, right? So electricity actually flows through this, an electromagnetic wave just flows through this axon, but as it flows, the intensity decreases, and eventually it's going to die away altogether. Okay, just because of the electrical properties. As this axon gets bigger and bigger in diameter, then this signal, okay, is able to stay inside the axon for a longer period of time. So the bigger the diameter of an axon, the better these graded potentials can travel. Right, so unmyelinated axons, if they're large, they can transmit information quickly, but if they're small diameter, they can't do that. All right, so, and the current just leaks out through different parts of the membrane. All right, so what I want you to see on this slide is that this is not an action potential. This is a graded potential, and this just has to do with electricity flowing through biological tissue because biological tissue has ions in it. And so that's what allows this electrical current to move through a cell. So that's what we call the cable properties of a cell. Cells can transmit electrical information, but as it's transmitted, what happens to it? It starts to fade away. Think of like maybe ringing of a bell or something. When you first hit a bell, the sound is really large, really loud, and then after a period of time, the sound gets what? Softer and softer and softer, and it just fades away. That's a property of a graded potential. Right? And graded potentials are produced by ligand-gated channels, not voltage-gated channels. So in this particular circumstance, I do not see any voltage-gated channels in this part of the axon. All right, so here we have, what kind of neuron is this? This is a little bit of a review. What kind of, well, do you believe me? Is this a neuron? Is this a neuron? Yeah. Now, what kind is it? Hey, it's a nice multipolar neuron. We have dendrites, cell body. Here's an axon. And we know that signals can flow from dendrites through cell body down an axon, right? And it goes in one direction. It cannot go backwards, right? So let's look at this area of an axon. And an axon has voltage-gated channels. So what kind of potential can move along an axon here, a graded potential or an action potential, since it has voltage-gated channels? Yeah, I want you to just think of those as almost like synonyms of each other. Voltage-gated channels produce action potentials. All right, so we have special proteins in the membrane. And when this cell gets stimulated, that which means that it becomes depolarized, and when that depolarization reaches this region over here, it can have an effect on the voltage-gated channels, causing them to open up, right? And when they open up, guess what happens? Sodium can enter the axon just in this one region right here. So this region of the axon depolarizes, and it changes the membrane potential, right, in these neighboring regions. It helps depolarize this neighboring region, and when the depolarization reaches threshold, what happens to this region right here? The channels open up, and that allows sodium to enter the axon at this location, right? And as this region depolarizes, then it pulls this region along with it. This one starts to depolarize a little bit, and then eventually it reaches threshold. So then what happens to this next chunk of the axon? It depolarizes, right? And it produces an action potential. So an action potential will sweep along an axon, and it can only sweep along an axon in one direction, okay? Because here we have depolarization. Why can't this region of significant depolarization cause depolarization in an area from where it came? How come the depolarization of an action potential can't go backwards or retrograde? Because this region right here is in a refractory period. It is just not sensitive to changes in membrane voltage because of that refractory period. It is only parts of the axon that are distal to this region here that are still sensitive, right, to changes in membrane voltage. This part of the axon is not in a refractory period. This one over here is, so this action potential can only move from left to right. Action potentials only go in one direction. And if it's an unmyelinated fiber, it actually has to move one voltage-gated channel by the next. It has to go from one voltage-gated channel to the next, to the next, to the next. So basically from molecule to molecule. And when that happens, it produces a very slow speed of conduction. When it goes from molecule to molecule, we call that continuous conduction. So there are action potentials, but there's going to be an action potential at every particular spot on the axon, so we call that continuous conduction. As opposed to if we have a myelinated axon. What have you learned about myelinated axons? Okay, well, you learn even in anatomy they're produced by what kind of cell in the peripheral nervous system? A Schwann cell, and the chemical that's in there is myelin. That's a lipid. Lipid is an insulator, right? It doesn't allow for anything electrical to pass through it. And so now we have that same axon, but it has a myelin sheath around it. Underneath this Schwann cell, we don't have any voltage-gated channels. No voltage-gated channels. So what does that mean? Can there be an action potential underneath a Schwann cell if there are no voltage-gated channels? And the answer is no. Okay. So these nodes between the Schwann cells have a special name. They're called nodes of Ranvier. This is where we have voltage-gated channels. So this area here, once it reaches threshold, it produces an action potential. And that change in voltage then moves underneath the myelin, underneath the Schwann cell, right, and it becomes a graded potential. So what happens to that signal when it starts to travel underneath the Schwann cell? It starts to die away, okay, and then it reaches the end of that Schwann cell into another node, but when it reaches the end of this Schwann cell over here, it is still at a threshold voltage. It hasn't died away completely. So what happens to the voltage-gated channels in this node of Ranvier? They start to open, and they produce another action potential. And that creates this electrical signal that dies away underneath the Schwann cell, but not so much that it goes below threshold by the time it reaches the second node. It's still at a threshold voltage, which produces what right here? Another action potential, right? And that process then proceeds down, okay, we call that antigrade direction. It can't go backwards because of refractory periods. That action potential doesn't flow over the surface. It does what? It hops from one node of Ranvier to the next, to the next, to the next, and that speeds up the rate of impulse conduction. So myelinated nerve fibers are a lot faster, okay, because that action potential doesn't just flow molecule by molecule. It actually just hops from one node to another. So, and we call that saltatory conduction. Continuous conduction that we have on that first example conducts impulses at about 2 miles an hour. If it is saltatory conduction because of myelinated axon, it can be as high as 300 miles per hour. So how many times faster is that? 2 versus 300. Okay, as hundreds of times, right? 150 times faster. So what's better? Faster or slower? Just like that commercial, right? Faster, much better. So myelinated axons is a more modern development in nerve conduction. We have mostly myelinated axons in our body, but we have a couple locations where they're not myelinated. And maybe from anatomy you could remember there are certain neurons in the autonomic nervous system that are not myelinated, so they don't look white, they look gray. And when we get into the next chapter, we'll talk about some of these things. All right, so what's the advantage of having myelinated axons? They are faster because an action potential will hop from one node to the next, to the next, to the next. And how come we don't have action potentials underneath the Schwann cell here? Because there are no voltage-gated channels. And that electrical signal just moves through this axon by those cable properties. It becomes a graded potential. Starts to die away, but it doesn't die away enough, right, to become sub-threshold by the time it reaches this next node. All right, so what's another way of thinking about saltatory conduction? Okay, let's just say that you're on the top of the stairs over here, and we want you to get down to the bottom of the stairs really fast. What would be the fastest way of the following two possibilities? Say you're going to run down, but you have to step on every step, right? And you can be fast doing that, but you have to step on every step. And then a second person will run down the steps, but they don't have to step on every single one. They can skip a couple. They can step on every third or every fourth step. Who's going to be faster? The person that's skipping down the stairs, right? Same thing for saltatory conduction in an axon that is myelinated. Saltatory conduction is faster because the action potential skips from one area to another. Voltage-gated sodium channels are present only at the nodes. That's right. Only action potentials are only produced at these nodes of Ranvier. Okay, so there are two kinds of potentials. We've got action potentials and then graded, and action potentials are always the same. Graded potentials can have a different amplitude, and as they travel down an axon, they die away. What about an action potential as it travels down an axon? Same amplitude, nothing changes, right? The duration, amplitude, nothing changes. And if it's saltatory, that action potential can actually skip, and that's faster than continuous conduction. Okay, so that's how information is transmitted along an axon. But there are times when information has to go from one cell to another, not just within one cell, but it has to go from one cell to another. We call that synaptic transmission, and it is due to a synapse. And so I would like for you to know that the synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Structural and functional unit of communication between cells is what we call a synapse. So if cells want to communicate with each other, what do they need? A synapse. Okay. And we got two kinds of synapses. We have chemical synapses and we have electrical synapses. And a chemical synapse, the thing that's transmitting information from one cell to another is a chemical. If it's an electrical synapse, the thing that's carrying information from one cell to the next is an electrical signal. So we got these two kinds. The cell that is sending the information right, is called the presynaptic cell. The cell that's receiving the information is the postsynaptic cell. And of course, these cells have membranes. So there's a presynaptic membrane and a postsynaptic membrane, and there's a space between them that we call the synaptic cleft. There's a space between these. Right, electrical synapses are not very common, but they are very common in the heart. We're going to see why that is, especially when we get to the heart chapter. So on this slide, I notice that there are two cells, or these pieces of two cells, and where I'm circling with the cursor, what are we looking at right here? We're looking at, the phospholipid bilayer, and indeed the inner part is the fatty region that water can't get across, ions can't get across, right? So this is a nice barrier to anything polar or anything that has an electrical charge. But these two cells, the top one and the bottom one, are connected together via these connexin proteins, and they're located right next to each other on either cell, and it forms a little canal or tunnel from one cell to another. Right, so this is going to be an example of an electrical synapse. So let's stimulate this top cell. How can we stimulate a cell? What do we do to it to stimulate it, to excite that cell? We get it to... Do we hyperpolarize it or depolarize it? Depolarize, which means that some kind of charge has to move. Which way does it, what kind of charge has to move if we depolarize this top cell? Like put a cation that's outside to the inside, right? Take a positive charge, put it on the inside, that's going to cause depolarization. And what kind of molecule do you know that cells use, your body uses all the time just to do that? Yeah, like sodium, right? So when the top cell is stimulated, sodium enters, right, and that causes depolarization of the top cell, but that also increases the concentration of sodium in the top cell. So now you have high concentration of sodium in the top cell, low concentration in the bottom cell. What does that mean? Concentration gradient, that produces a gradient for diffusion, so sodium will want to diffuse from the top to the bottom cell. What else? The bottom cell is still negative. And that's going to draw sodium in. So sodium will move from the top cell into the bottom cell through this thing that we call a gap junction. And when it does, it just brings that electrical signal into the bottom cell, and it causes, what does it cause? It causes depolarization in the bottom cell. So depolarization will move from one cell to another, right, through these gap junctions, because sodium, right, will move across. All right, that's an electrical synapse. So these cells have to be pretty close together, right? And these gap junctions have to be there formed by the connexin proteins, electrical synapse. By far, the more common one is what we call a chemical synapse. Oh, I tell you what, I want to go back just one slide. So the top cell is what we call the presynaptic cell. The bottom one is the postsynaptic, because the postsynaptic is receiving a signal from the presynaptic cell. All right, so information on this next slide starts in the top cell and it goes into the bottom one. All right, so information flows from top to bottom. So this top cell, is this the presynaptic or the postsynaptic cell? That's the pre. And the one on the bottom is the post, because it's going to be receiving that information. All right, but there are no gap junctions right here. So electrical signals can't go from the presynaptic into the postsynaptic. I suppose it could if there were lightning bolts going across the space between there, but our bodies don't have anything like lightning bolts. Right? So the signal is a chemical signal. The chemical signal is held in vesicles inside this terminus of an axon. Right? So we could call this an axon terminus. It kind of looks like a button, so sometimes we call that a terminal button. Sometimes it's called a bouton terminale. It runs around with a bunch of different names, but it's a swelling at the end of an axon, and it's a swelling because it contains all of these vesicles, which has a chemical that's going to be a signaling molecule to the postsynaptic cell. And since these are neurons, that signaling compound is called a neurotransmitter, because the top cell is a neuron, and it's going to transmit that information to the postsynaptic cell via that chemical, neurotransmitter. Okay, so let's start with an action potential coming down the axon, and when it gets to the axon terminus, not only does it have a sodium voltage gated channel, potassium voltage gated channel. It also has a calcium voltage gated channel just in this location of the axon in the terminal button. So when the action potential comes down, these calcium channels reach threshold, and what do? When they reach threshold, they change conformation, they open up. And which way is calcium going to go? Is calcium going to go any which way at all? What can you tell me about calcium in a normal, nice, healthy, living cell? Is calcium the same across the membrane, or is there a difference in concentration? Difference in concentration. Huge difference in concentration, as a matter of fact. And where is it higher, inside or outside? It's high outside, very low, extremely low inside. So as soon as this channel opens, what happens to calcium? It rushes in just due to that concentration gradient. All right, and when calcium rushes in, it binds to another molecule that we call calmodulin. Cal for calcium and modulin because it's going to modulate the activity of things inside this axon terminus. All right, so calmodulin then bumps into something called protein kinase. And this particular protein kinase is inactive. But if it were active, what would this protein kinase do? What would it do? It would phosphorylate other kinds of molecules, like proteins inside the cell, change the shape of those proteins, which means what could it do? It could change the function of those proteins, how those proteins function in this region of the cell. All right, so calmodulin is the signal that activates this protein kinase. It becomes active, and it's floating around inside the cell, and it starts to phosphorylate a bunch of other kinds of proteins that cause these vesicles to move over to the presynaptic membrane to dock with it. And after it docks, there are other regulatory proteins that cause that vesicle to open up, and then all of this neurotransmitter that was in a vesicle deep inside the cell is now released into this space between cells. That space is what we call the synaptic cleft. All right, so we have a high concentration of neurotransmitter up against the presynaptic cell, very low concentration up against the membrane on the postsynaptic cell. So what's going to happen to neurotransmitter? It's going to diffuse down a concentration gradient from high to low. So it's going to just move by diffusion from the presynaptic membrane to the postsynaptic membrane. And as it's doing that, it is carrying information. It's transmitting information into the postsynaptic cell. But in order for the postsynaptic cell to be sensitive to neurotransmitter, what does it need? It needs a receptor, right? So there has to be a receptor in the postsynaptic membrane that's complementary to the shape of the neurotransmitter. And when it binds to that receptor, it's going to change something. It's going to open up a sodium gate, right? And then sodium is going to enter the postsynaptic cell, and then what happens to the postsynaptic cell when sodium rushes in? It depolarizes, right? The membrane potential changes. And when it depolarizes, that's going to produce a graded potential, right? So remember, ligand-gated channels produce graded potentials. The ligand in this particular case is the neurotransmitter. And we could even be a little bit more specific. We could actually come up with a name for a neurotransmitter. So neurotransmitter is a ligand. And a neurotransmitter could be a particular molecule like what? What's your favorite neurotransmitter? Maybe acetylcholine is a really good example. So in this particular case, the ligand is acetylcholine binding to the receptor on this postsynaptic cell. And when it does, it opens up a sodium channel. Okay, talked about that. Talked about that. Calmodulin. How did calmodulin get its name? Because calcium has to get inside the axon terminus, right? And then information can be transmitted across the synapse. So if you were a body and you had a decision to make where to put calcium, and your choice was put calcium in bones to make bones nice, strong, and healthy, or to put calcium in the extracellular space so that neurons could talk to each other, what would you choose? Would you rather have strong bones or a nervous system that could function because synapses were working? Yeah, probably nervous system. And guess what? Your body does make that choice. So as we get older and we lose calcium from our body, maybe because we don't have vitamin D and we don't have enough calcium in our diet, Where does your body get calcium to make sure that your nervous system works properly? Gets it from a reservoir, which is your skeleton. Right? And then what happens to your skeleton? It gets weaker. And what do we call that condition? Osteoporosis. And that happens to everybody, but certain people are a little bit more sensitive than others. And that is, and those are women. Because men's bones typically are a bit bigger, so they can afford to lose a lot more calcium before they become weak enough to break on their own. So if you're a woman with big, strong bones, you're kind of protected from osteoporosis. But if you're a woman with kind of small bones, then you're more susceptible to osteoporosis because that calcium is used for other important kinds of things like synaptic transmission, okay, which we just described right here. Okay, some things about synaptic transmission. The ligand has to diffuse across the synaptic cleft. Right? It's got to bind to a receptor on the postsynaptic membrane, and when it does, it opens a ligand-gated channel, or we could say a chemically regulated channel, ion channel. Right? And if predominantly that ligand opens up a channel that sodium can diffuse through, it produces that excitatory event, causes depolarization. We're going to call that an excitatory postsynaptic potential. It's a graded potential, can have different amplitudes, but it's always going to cause the membrane potential to move back to zero, which is what we call depolarization. There are other kind of channels that, when a ligand binds to them, will allow potassium to leave. And what happens then when potassium leaves? What happens to membrane potential then? It increases, right? It hyperpolarizes. And it moves farther away from threshold. So if membrane potential moves farther away from threshold, that inhibits the cell. And so that kind of signal then is what we call an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. So neurotransmitters can excite the postsynaptic cell or it can inhibit depending on what it does to the membrane potential. Right? If it causes depolarization, it produces an EPSP. If it causes hyperpolarization, then it causes an IPSP, which inhibits that cell. Right? And so those are all, and because these different graded potentials, whether they're excitatory or inhibitory, they affect voltage-gated channels, right, in the postsynaptic cell, because the voltage-gated channels are sensitive to changes in voltage, whether it's an EPSP or an IPSP. All right, so EPSPs and IPSPs are not action potentials. They are graded potentials. They vary in intensity. All right, and what about an action potential as it moves along an axon? Does it change amplitude? Action potential? Always the same. Graded potential, on the other hand, dies away over time. Right, so graded potentials are due to these ligand-gated channels. Where we find ligand-gated channels is not an axon, but a dendrite and the cell body. Dendrite and cell body. What kind of channels does an axon have? Voltage-gated, because that's where we find action potentials. Right, but so dendrites and cell bodies don't produce action potentials because they don't have voltage-gated channels. They only have ligand-gated channels. And these graded potentials are variable in amplitude. They propagate with decrement, which means as they travel over the cell, they start to go away, they start to dissipate. But here is something that's really important. Unlike action potentials, they can add together. Right? So we say they can summate. So if you have an IPSP and an EPSP at the same time, they can cancel each other out. Or if you have two sub-threshold EPSPs, they can add together to make a threshold stimulus. So the beauty of a graded potential, even though they die away over time, they can add together. Right? So they can add together to make a threshold stimulus, or they can subtract from each other and make a threshold stimulus a non-threshold stimulus. And that's all within one cell. Okay, so what part of a neuron is the receiving part and why? Dendrite, okay, and cell body, and why is that the receiving end of a neuron? because it has ligand-gated channels, it needs to receive a signal from a neighboring neuron, namely a neurotransmitter. It needs to receive a neurotransmitter that is going to cause a graded potential, so that's the receiving part. What part of the neuron is the sending part, and why? Axon is the sending part, and why could that possibly be? Because it has different kind of channels, it has voltage-gated channels. Right, and that voltage-gated channel produces an action potential that's going to move down the axon from the proximal region of an axon to the distal region, which has those axon termini. All right, so there's a really good exam figure that one of my students drew out that's in the study guide, and it has all this information. So you probably would want to maybe just draw that out as well as be able to label that figure. And I'm going to talk about this a whole bunch more, too. Question? Indeed, and we're going to see how that is. Indeed, that is. So, graded potentials, as they move from a dendrite into a cell body, they move into an axon, and if that graded potential is at threshold when it reaches the axon, what will it produce? An action potential, if it's a threshold graded potential. If it's sub-threshold, then the axon is just going to ignore that signal. So, that's kind of interesting because every single neuron in your body, right, has these regions of graded potentials and action potentials, and every single neuron can make up its own mind whether or not it's going to transmit an action potential. The cell body and dendrites will integrate information up, right, whether it's a positive or negative signal. It adds all of these signals together to make a decision on what to do, and if all these things add together, if EPSPs and IPSPs add together to produce a threshold stimulus, then that neuron decides to send an action potential all the way down the axon to the axon terminus. If these things add together and only produce a sub-threshold stimulus, then the decision that neuron makes is to ignore all of these signals. So you could think of every neuron in your body sort of acting like a brain, making decisions for you based on how these EPSPs and IPSPs add together. All right, so we set, oh, here's a nice illustration of a neuron. We got dendrites, cell body, axon. All right, does this axon transmit information quickly or slowly? Quickly, because it is myelinated. Action potential will skip from one node of Ranvier to the other. All right, and we said axons produce action potentials because they have voltage-gated channels. Dendrites and nerve cell body produce graded potentials because they only have ligand-gated channels, no voltage-gated channels. And where the cell converts from ligand-gated channels to voltage-gated channels is right here at the axon hillock. This is where the membrane proteins start to change from ligand to voltage-gated channels. All right, so here we have two neurons. Looks like a red one and a yellow one. Let's pretend those are the right colors. But anyway, these red ones are what? The presynaptic neurons. This yellow one right here is the postsynaptic. Information is going to flow from pre to postsynaptic membrane because this is a chemical synapse. Question? It's right in between. When I look at this, I don't see an axon, I don't see cell body. When I look at the axon hillock, I actually see something that I have in my garage and I have in my kitchen. What happens if I have a bottle with a small mouth and I want to pour some stuff in there? I would want to use a funnel, something that's really big at one end, really small on the other, so that when I pour stuff into it, it ends up inside the bottle, right? So when I look at this axon hillock, I see a transition zone, I see a funnel. And what this funnel does, it takes information from dendrites and the cell body and condenses it right into this region. All right, so that's what the axon hillock is. So it's a transition zone between areas that are dendrites and cell body and the area that is the axon. And they have different membrane proteins. So I wouldn't say either. I think most people would classify it as part of the axon, but I think it's really good for you to see it as a transition zone. Yeah. Okay. in this region right here, the axon hillock. This is where the proximal part, you might find some ligand-gated channels mixed in with a few voltage-gated channels. And as you move deeper and deeper and deeper into the axon hillock, then you'll see less and less ligand-gated channels and more voltage-gated channels. I don't think there's like a separation all of a sudden. I see it as a transition. Okay. So as you move from one end of the axon hillock to the other, right, you're going to switch from ligand-gated channels 100% to 100% voltage-gated channels. And it's not like a step. It's not like instantaneous that that happens. So the first place that, as a signal is injected into the cell, the first place that has voltage-gated channels is the axon hillock. So this is the first place where an action potential can be stimulated, not on dendrites and cell body because there's no voltage-gated channels, only ligand-gated channels. All right, so if there are no voltage-gated channels and dendrites in the cell body, only ligand, what kinds of electrical signals do we have in dendrites and cell body? Action potentials or graded potentials? They're graded potentials, and if you're just kind of memorizing that for right now, that's okay. Right? And then these graded potentials move from this dendrite, right, all over the cell. It's just an electrical signal that travels through the cell, and it gets to the axon hillock. Okay? Describe what that graded potential looks like on the dendrite compared to when it gets to the axon hillock. What's happening to it? It's dying away, right? It's decreasing. That's why we call it a graded potential, right? It dies away. And if it dies away to where it's a sub-threshold stimulus, what happens to the production of an action potential right here in the axon hillock? It won't happen, right? Even though it received an excitatory signal from the presynaptic neuron, by the time it gets way over here, this postsynaptic neuron is going to ignore it because it hasn't reached threshold. Right. But if that graded potential from a presynaptic neuron is so great that it is still at a threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock, what's the decision that this neuron is going to make? It's going to start an action potential, and then what's going to happen to that action potential? It's going to skip down the axon all the way to the axon terminus. And what can you tell me about an action potential here in the axon hillock and an action potential at the axon terminus? Exactly the same. That's why axons can be really long. They can go from your central nervous system to the tip of your toe without losing any kind of signal because action potentials travel without decrement. They actually just skip down the axon. And that's all just due to changes in permeability to sodium and potassium, right, through the membrane at these nodes of RONVA. All right, so we can see that there are numerous synapses between presynaptic cell and this one postsynaptic cell, and they all start graded potentials. What is something else that's different about a graded potential compared to an action potential? Not only does their amplitude decrease, but there's something that's really good, something that's special, something that is good, that action potentials can't do. They can add together, right? They can add together. So, and we call that summation. So let's just say we have these two presynaptic neurons. They're going to stimulate the postsynaptic cell, but each of these neurons by themselves don't produce a graded potential big enough to reach threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock. But because graded potentials summate, right, if both of the presynaptic neurons produce a small graded potential, what can they do if they're both EPSPs, if they're both excitatory but small? Let's just say this one, and this one, right, stimulate four small graded potentials, what can they do? They can add together to be a big graded potential, and that can stimulate an action potential when it gets to the axon hillock. So that's why we say the cell body is an integration center, because it's receiving information from all of these presynaptic neurons, and then the postsynaptic neuron, in a sense, decides what to do with that information. If it reaches threshold, it produces an action potential. If not, then that information just goes away because it's not important. All right, so here is a flow diagram for synaptic transmission. We see the three areas of a synapse. We see the presynaptic neuron, the postsynaptic neuron, and what's the third area? It's not labeled. Presynaptic, postsynaptic neuron. We see the, what is this space right here called? That is the synaptic cleft, right? And electrical signals can't get through here. Only chemical signals move across the synaptic cleft by diffusion. So the presynaptic cell has high concentration of neurotransmitter. The postsynaptic membrane has low concentration, so that neurotransmitter is going to move by diffusion. All right, so let's look at these three different regions. Action potential conducted down by an axon to the axon terminus. When it gets to the axon terminus, it runs into another special membrane protein, a voltage-gated membrane protein. And that one is specific for calcium. Remember, calcium is really high outside, super low inside. So calcium is going to rush inside the cell. And when it does, it activates calmodulin. Calmodulin activates a bunch of enzymes that phosphorylate other kinds of proteins inside the axon terminus, changing their shape, changing their activity. That causes the vesicles to move to the presynaptic membrane and release of neurotransmitter. All right, so how does this neurotransmitter get from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell? What's that process? Yeah. High concentration to low concentration. Just diffusion, right? So it just diffuses across the synaptic cleft. And the postsynaptic cell will completely ignore that neurotransmitter unless it has what? A receptor for it. It's got to have a membrane protein that has complementary shape to the neurotransmitter. And when it binds to the receptor, it opens up another ion channel, a sodium channel. Sodium rushes into the postsynaptic cell. And what do we know about that when sodium rushes in? What happens? Depolarization or hyperpolarization? D, right? Because sodium is a positive charge that causes depolarization. And in this particular case, is that an excitatory or inhibitory event when the cell depolarizes? That's excitatory, right? So now that signal has gone from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic. That excitatory signal is just a graded potential. It's going to flow over the whole cell, but as it moves from one location to another, what happens to the amplitude? It starts to die away because it's a graded potential, right? But when that graded potential gets to the axon hillock, if it reaches threshold, or maybe other graded potentials join it at the axon hillock from different locations, from other neurons, and it reaches threshold, what happens? What's something special at the axon hillock when all those graded potentials get together? That can trigger an action potential. And where does that action potential go? Back to the dendrite or down the axon to the axon terminus? Only down the axon to the axon terminus. Okay, because you could invoke a refractory period, but you could also say, well, it doesn't go back to the dendrite because the cell body doesn't have voltage-gated channels. Only has ligand-gated channels. Right, so it can't go backwards. Okay, let's look at an acetylcholine channel. I'll go back to many of those previous slides in just a little bit. All right, so what is something that you're really familiar with on this slide? Phospholipid bilayer. This oily region on the inside, preventing ions to move across. But here is a protein that goes across the membrane, and it can be closed or it can be open. So this is, a gated channel because it can open or close. When it's open, guess what sodium likes to do? Rush inside the cell, right? When it's closed, sodium can't get across. And as sodium rushes into the cell, what happens to the cell? It becomes depolarized. That's an excitatory signal. This right here is what we call a nicotinic acetylcholine channel. And in order for this channel to open up, two molecules of acetylcholine have to bind to it. Right, and when they bind to it, that changes the conformation. It's like your friend poking you in the side. Not a really big energy change, but enough to change conformation to get this protein to open, right, causing depolarization. So this is what we call a nicotinic acetylcholine channel. That's a channel that's opened directly as a result of neurotransmitter binding to it. And we have these kinds of acetylcholine channels in a lot of places in our body. Certainly at every neuromuscular junction has these. nicotinic type acetylcholine channel. So a nicotinic acetylcholine channel is always excitatory because sodium always rushes inside the cell. There's another kind of acetylcholine channel, and it's a G-protein coupled channel. I think you had G-protein coupled figure on your first test. Maybe you should go back and kind of look at it or put that picture back in your mind for right now. A G-protein coupled channel is you have a receptor, right? And the receptor is where? Inside the cell or outside the cell? It's outside the cell, just like the receptor on this nicotinic channel is outside, right? But the G-protein coupled, the receptor is outside. That protein goes all the way across the membrane and it's attached to a G-protein. Right? And a G-protein has three subunits associated with it, and it works properly because it binds GTP. That's why we call it a G-protein. And, well, here it is. Right? So here is a nice phospholipid bilayer. I see the receptor, and here is the active site of the receptor. So acetylcholine can bind to it because it's complementary in shape to acetylcholine. And when it binds, right, it changes the conformation all the way through the membrane and transmits that conformation change to these subunits, the alpha, beta, and gamma, causes them to dissociate from the receptor. And when they dissociate, they can float around inside the membrane or right on the surface of the membrane. They move around by diffusion. They bump into a whole bunch of things. And in particular, they could bump into a potassium channel. So in this case, the beta and gamma subunits stick together, and they have a certain shape when they stick together. They bind to this potassium channel. Okay, and let's just say before beta and gamma bound to the potassium channel, it was closed. And as soon as they bind, the channel opens up, and guess what's going to happen to potassium then? It's going to leave the cell, right, because there's high concentration of potassium inside, low on the outside. Potassium is going to leave the cell. What does that do to the membrane potential across the membrane as positive charges leave? The inside becomes more negative. What do we call that? That's hyperpolarization. And is that excitatory or inhibitory? It's inhibitory because what happens to the membrane potential? Does it go closer to threshold or does it move farther away from threshold when it hyperpolarizes? It moves farther away. We call that inhibition because now you need a much greater stimulus to reach threshold. So in this particular channel, right, we call this a muscarinic acetylcholine channel. This would be when potassium leaves, that would cause hyperpolarization. This would be called an inhibitory channel. Right? But if it bumps into, if the beta and gamma or maybe an alpha bumps into another kind of protein, that's a sodium channel. Let's now convert this to sodium. Which way is sodium going to go? From outside to inside, what's that going to cause? Not hyperpolarization, but depolarization. And what do you know about depolarization? Excitatory or inhibitory? It's excitatory. So muscarinic type channels, acetylcholine channels, can either be hyperpolarizing or inhibitory or depolarizing and excitatory. Right? Muscarinic can be either one, just depending on what the cell has decided to put into the cell membrane. What about nicotinic channels? What about nicotinic acetylcholine channels? 100% excitatory because sodium is going to enter the cell. So there's a difference between nicotinic and muscarinic channels, and it can produce different effects. So how can one neurotransmitter produce different effects inside your body? It all depends on the type of receptor that it binds to. We always use that as a way to explain how one single neurotransmitter in our body can cause a number of different effects, right? Because then it will just bind to different kinds of receptors. Even though the active site has to be very similar, the active site is not exactly equal because the reason why we call this a muscarinic receptor because it also binds a chemical that comes from a mushroom. And when that chemical, which we call muscarin, binds to this receptor, it kills this receptor. All right? And so that's a very deadly poison when you start to wipe out all these receptors in your body. Right, so that's why when you eat mushrooms, you got to be really careful. You got to make sure that it's the right kind of mushroom that doesn't have muscarin in it, right? Because it's going to kill all the muscarinic type receptors that you have in your body. All right, this other one over here, nicotinic type receptor, is one that also binds nicotine, and it can cause this channel to open. That's one reason why nicotine is such a powerful drug in people, because it works with these kinds of receptors, always causing what? Excitatory events wherever these nicotinic receptors are. All right, so nicotinic receptor, remember, is directly related to the opening and closing of these channels. And muscarinic receptors have to work through this G protein to indirectly open or close channels. Right, the nicotinic always opens a channel. The muscarinic can either open or close a channel. Thus, it can have either excitatory or inhibitory effects on various parts of your body. Okay, I think we got to stop there. So we got one more period to cover some things. All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about acetylcholine. And we need a way to terminate the action of acetylcholine so that it can be used as a signal pathway again in the future. I guess a good way to think of that, we have a switch on the wall that can turn a light on or off. But would that be a really useful switch if you could only use it one time to turn the lights on and then you couldn't use that switch anymore? Or turn the lights off and then you couldn't use that switch anymore? What would you like that switch to be? Be able to turn on, right? Turn off and then turn on again, turn off again. And so acetylcholine can't stick around forever, because then that cell would be stuck in that condition. All right, you've got to be able to use it like a switch. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around somewhere. And there are lights in here, too, somewhere. I didn't pass around a sign-in sheet? Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, I have it underneath the paper towels right there. It's too late to pass it around. Sorry. Yeah, you could have skipped class.